Thank you ever so much for coming on one of the most beautiful days of the year. I'm determined not to depress you, which is not easy given Shattered Nation as the title and given what the book's about. I've sat in four of these talks over the last 2 days, very impressive talks, but what's been most interesting have been the questions. So I am relying on you. I'm going to get through this in 25 minutes. So we've got lots and lots of time for questions. I'm not going to labour the issue of how shattered we are too much, because if you were in Will Hutton's talk last night, he stole half my stats, so you'll know. But before you sort of think I'm not being zoned, this is a terrible situation. You're going to see some fairly shocking things. The interesting thing, of course, is what do we do about it? But you're not going to do anything about it if you don't think it's bad. So you have to be convinced it's bad. There are lots of things you can do, most of which we're told are impossible. They just happen to occur elsewhere in Europe, including, this is an advert to go on holiday in Greece this year, you may not realise that should you be mad enough to want a cheese toastie on the beach on one of those islands in the Aegean, the price is controlled. That's for you as tourists. It's not the price of food for people in Greece, which of course is also controlled for basics, or in many other parts of Europe. That's to stop people being greedy, making money out of you, so that you go back to Greece again. Now we're taught, we teach our economic students, that this kind of thing is madness. Whereas what we do is apparently wonderful. And if only everybody else in the world copied us, they'd all be rich. Now, thankfully, we have kind of done the experiment. We've taken it through. We've shown what happens if you behave following that economic logic of free markets, no controls, let people be evicted from their house with just 2 months' notice. We've kind of shown that. But you may not think it. It's easy if you live where I live in Oxford, or you live here, I've just been on the walk, very, very nice. It's easy to think, actually, things aren't that bad. What are they moaning about? Surely if they just saved a little bit more and were less feckless and worked harder, it would all be okay. We have particular problems in the UK that other countries don't. One of which is that we used to own all of this, which is much more, those circles are sized by the population of all the parts of the world which were parts of the British Empire. It's much more than all the other empires of the world put together. And we lost it, which is fine and good, but you can't just lose an empire and be okay. Right? If you're trying to think of reasons about why we are like we are. Bizarre things are happening. The paper of record for the left in England is now the Financial Times. In case you're still buying the Guardian, you need to buy the FT. Why is the FT more left-wing than the Guardian? Because it's selling to the mainland of Europe, and it needs to be taken seriously. So it needs to actually say things which are plausible and fairly true. Whereas if you're just selling a newspaper in England, you don't have to say things which are true. In fact, you can sell many copies by spouting lies. This graph, John Byrne Murdoch drew just over a year ago. He was using data collected by political scientists around the world. Every circle is a political party. All the rich countries of the world are included, and all the middle-income countries of the world are included. So you've got every single political party shown as a small circle. And if you look all the way across to the right, you'll see that the most extreme, economically far-right political party on the planet is the British Conservative Party, right? In the Financial Times, data collected by international political scientists without an axe to grind. Somewhere has to be weird. At some time, you have to be living in a weird time. That's here and that's now. Now, to be honest, that was Liz Truss, okay? But we're still kind of vying on that edge of the spectrum of possibilities. These slides are for when I do this talk to school children, where I am more polite and less obvious, but I won't go through them in detail. But there's a lot about sharing. This is a picture of me and my children 10 years ago by a river on South Island, New Zealand, where the British had built a bridge across the river. The water coming down is fast flowing, it's freezing cold, it's from the Southern Alps. And there's a plaque by the bridge saying, this is what the wonderful engineers built. And before then, all the Maori could do was cross over it, holding a wooden pole to protect the weakest. Now, they weren't holding a wooden pole to protect the weakest. If you didn't hold a pole while you're crossing that river with the water coming up this high, any of you would be swept off your feet and could well die. But we've found it very hard to get in our heads that you do things better collectively. We have a great hero, an exceptional kind of way of thinking, which worked very well for invading what are now 190 of the countries of the UN, for controlling the passes of mountains with only 6 men, for ruling what became Nigeria with a tiny number of people schooled in the art of geography. If you ever wondered why you did geography at school, rivers, mountains, resources, peoples, right? It's the study of learning how to be a colonial officer. Right? That's why it isn't taught in other countries, except for Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, a bit in the USA. It's a minor subject in other countries. It's changing now, of course. We no longer teach people to be colonial officers because there's not much point. There aren't many colonies left. The main subjects of geography at university now are climate change and global inequality and poverty. Right? So we're still going. I produced too many graphs, but there are none in the book. So if you don't like graphs, none of these are in the book. There are 150 on the website of the book that anybody can look at, because I probably won't convince those of you who don't agree with me about political views. Political views are a bit like religion. It's very hard to give up your religion. But there's lots and lots of data out there. And the data is fascinating. This little spiral, there's a book, it's only got 3 copies. There's a book I did called Slow Down, which is full of spiral graphs. Spiral graphs are called phase diagrams in physics, are ways of looking at change over time. On that graph, on the vertical axis, you've got how well is the Conservative Party doing versus Labour. At the top is where Johnson won his great big majority in 2019. Along the side, the horizontal axis is how fast is it moving. And it spiraled round. This is just in the year to 2019. Labour were ahead in May 2019. Right? Strange things have happened in our recent past. You often forget the Labour Party were 10 points ahead in May 2019. What went wrong between May 2019 and December 2019 to result in such an enormous landslide? Why did it go wrong? Why did people... You've got to be quick with these graphs, I'm afraid. Why did people vote as they did, in what numbers, and not vote? 2 million people didn't vote who'd voted in 2017. My favourite story of this is one of the porters at Oxford, when I said, how are you voting? And he said, I'm not voting Labour because of that Corbyn. I'm never going to vote for a Labour Party led by Corbyn. I said, how did you vote in 2017? He went, I voted Labour. Um, 66 million people, children can't vote, people who are European citizens but not Ireland and so on can't vote. We divide it into age groups. You can't get a chunk of 1 million Tory voters below the age of 45. Being a bit heartless about this, that's before a pandemic which almost entirely killed people who were elderly and aging. But there we have a summary. I promised just 25 minutes of me talking, and I'll keep to it. This is just words, if you like reading words. I don't like people looking at me. which is one reason I produce graphs and strange pictures. There's all kind of artwork being produced at the moment about the crisis. This is the Moral Compass, which is actually a piece of art about where we are. You're going to get a lot later about how badly children are doing. But what's often not recognised is that pensioners, this is the income of the median pensioner. Pensioners have been doing badly too. You might think, well, how can it have stalled since 2010 for pensioners, given we got a triple lock? And the answer, this graph is from ONS, is that we took away so many other benefits that pensioners used to get, particularly discretionary ones if you're in circumstances that were very hard, that the pensioners of Britain hardly became any better off in the last 14 years. The group that is said to have actually been the only winners didn't. I'm not quite sure why. He's a pensioner. That's why they included the king. That was the moment he became king. Just as he, I won't say any more about him. Do you remember David Cameron saying he was going to make everybody happy? Yeah. But shortly after he became Prime Minister in 2010, I think it was just after he'd flown out to hug a husky. And that was shortly after he'd flown to South Africa to be photographed with Nelson Mandela. First thing he did. You've got to ask yourself, why did he need to be photographed next to Nelson Mandela? And who had the photograph of him when he was a teenage boy in Oxford? Anyway, it wasn't me. I was a teenage boy in Oxford, not at the university, at the same time as David. He promised to make everybody happy. Being a proper conservative, he never bothered to look at the data. Conservatives don't like data. Margaret Thatcher cut the budget of the Office of Population and Censuses by 25% when she became Prime Minister. Conservatives are constantly threatening to get rid of the census. They've almost managed it. It's not a full census now. He should have looked at the data because people got happier. These are the measures from the components of the index that ONS dutifully produced on what proportion of people say that things are worthwhile in life, how many say they're satisfied with their life on a scale from 1 to 10, how many on the 1 to 10 scale say how happy they are, that kind of thing. You might think these questions are a bit anodyne, but if you ask them the same way to the same group of people, they produce a pattern that's interesting. And it went up and up and up gradually. It kind of goes down seasonally and up seasonally. That's why you get the sawtooth pattern. I've put it up partly because I think it's interesting. I suspect the reason for it going up was that we were still in the aftermath of the biggest financial crash since 1929. If you remember 2008, we weren't sure that the banks would survive. House prices could have plummeted and carried on going down. Could have had 4 or 5 million people unemployed after 2008. None of that actually happened. Population gradually becomes happier. Most people's lives are not terrible. Most people's lives are still better than their parents were at their age, and certainly better than their grandparents at their age. But then a terrible event occurred. Can you see that it's going down? Now, the really interesting question is, what is that terrible event? It's not the pandemic. I've put a line on for the very first moment that we heard about the virus from Wuhan. It's around about February 2020. Something occurred in October, November, and December.
General election.
Yes. It wasn't just a general election. Proroguing of Parliament, sacking of ministers, lying to the Queen, and then that enormous majority. Now, you might have thought, well, the people who voted, surely they were so happy by getting what they wanted, getting Brexit done, remember, that their increased happiness and jubilance that Boris had come in would outweigh the sadness. But no. In fact, the increase in unhappiness, here's a better one, anxiety makes it clearer. The increase in anxiety that was associated with Johnson winning the general election was only beaten by that feeling you had when the second wave of COVID began in December 2020 and you realised this disease is not going to go away. Right? That's how bad it was. Why do we get this pattern? And here I'm being careful because I jump from, this is real. My interpretation is just an interpretation. Why over this period that I'm going to claim things were shattering, weren't the population becoming more anxious? Well, lots of people had hope. We were going to get a referendum. We knew once the 2015 election had happened and Cameron didn't take his friend George Osborne's advice that there's going to be a referendum, it's promised. Lots of people wanted a referendum. We voted in June 2016, and the majority of people got what they wanted. 52% got Brexit. They didn't get it straight away. Okay, it was a bit painful, but they thought they were going to get it. There were another 48% of people who voted. Remember, lots of people didn't vote, of course, who were not that bothered about these things, but we forget about them. Another 48% voted to remain. And for several years, they thought, well, maybe we will remain. Maybe we'll have enough referendum. Maybe we'll just not do this because it's advisory. Politically, if you're on the far right, you're beginning to get the kind of politics you've been hoping for all your life. Right? With the promise of even more of the truth and the light that the Liz Trusses and the Rishi Sunaks might one day end up in charge. If you're politically on the British left, which means mainstream European, think Merkel, 500,000 of you joined a political party and created the largest social movement in Europe. And you had the biggest swing in the election of 2017 ever recorded in modern time per year. Much, much bigger than the 1935 to 45 swing. There were lots of reasons not to be anxious before Johnson secured that majority. But things were getting worse. You were repeatedly told, I've got 5 minutes, so you're not going to get too many graphs, but you're going to get them fast. You're repeatedly told by chancellors at every budget that inequality is reduced. They refer to this data is the ratio of the median household in the bottom fifth to the median household in the top fifth. Because it's a median, it ignores everybody below and above. So if you ignore the 10% poorest people in Britain and you ignore the 10% richest, yes, we become more equal. I think none of the chancellors, bar George Osborne, realised they were lying. I could be wrong. I challenged them to prove they actually understood what they were saying. Clearly, a official in the Treasury was giving them the same line because the chancellors kept on changing, but the bit of the speech stayed the same. What was really going on? The top 1% were taking more and more. Top 10% were getting richer. This is most of us. You've paid some money to come to a festival, right? I can stereotype you. At least in your working lives, you will have been in the top 10%. You may not have thought you were, but you and I almost certainly were. We take 40% of everything a year, leaving the rest, 90% of the population, with just 60% to live on. But we don't feel bad because those 1%ers at the top, they're taking so much that we look positively frugal. And we can look to the USA. So here's the curves over time of what the 1% take over a century in five separate countries. Everywhere was incredibly unequal 100 years ago. Upstairs, downstairs, servants, aristocrats. All plummets down, slightly more slowly for the USA. And then the 1% begin to take more and more, particularly in the United States, which is the one place that makes us look good in numerous ways. We're the next line below the US. And then if you've got very good eyesight, you'll see Switzerland, Japan, and the Netherlands. If you go to the Netherlands and have a look around and wonder, why do they look healthier? Why are they taller? Why are their clothes better? It's not just that they haven't suffered from what we've suffered since 2008. It's because they're more equal, like all the rest of Europe now is. Every single country. United States, much richer. Along the bottom, you've got salaries going up to $400,000 a year. What does $400,000 a year get you in the United States? Well, the thing that matters most in life is health. It varies by age. Youngsters don't say that. They're into love and other things. But, you know, when you get older, you know. The thing that matters most in life is health, life expectancy. On average, you're getting yourself 85 years if you're in the top 1% in the US. Exactly the same as England. All that extra money, all that extra wealth, incredible amount spent on health, 16% of GDP in the United States. No overall benefit, even for the richest of all. Not worth it. Had to run the experiment. We wouldn't have known. You couldn't have told. I mean, it's quite an incredible result. You'd have thought, oh, at least the top 1% should have got something. You know, they might have lost their soul. Their children with any morals might hate them, but, you know, they should get something. But no, they don't. And our little curve, that's the worst curve. Now, bar, I think, about three or four countries in Eastern Europe which are still worse than us. But coming up, neonatal mortality. There's about only five countries in Eastern Europe which it's higher than it is here. We are peripheral. We are now a peripheral European country. You can draw lots and lots of graphs. This one is infant mortality versus inequality. The circles towards the bottom are the European countries drawn with a size proportional to the population, and the United States, all the individual states are showing. The states of the US are much more unequal places. At the extreme, you've got Alabama. And bad things happen more often in more unequal places. Right. The spirit level showed this in 2010. That's a long, long time ago. Inequality is bad for you, including for the rich. Here's voting for the far right. I did label the Republican Party with Trump as its head as far right. I think that's fair enough. But again, you've got a kind of correlation that the ones that misbehave are Germany. For some reason, Germany doesn't vote for the far right as much as it ought to, historic. And France used to a bit more. So you get lots of patterns like that. I've got 1 minute if I'm going to keep to my promise. Give me three, but we've got loads of time for questions. And hopefully I've provoked you, and you'll ask, here's our continent. It's a stretch map. Areas proportional to people. There is Madrid, Paris, London. Those lovely Nordic countries, which are very, very lovely, but very small, so we can kind of forget about them. Turkey, trying to come into the EU. Greece is Athens, right? Different kind of map. What can we use the map for? Lots of different things. Let's have a look at migration. The dark blue areas are where over 20% of people are migrants. If you thought that we voted to leave the EU because we had loads of migrants, no, we didn't. Of course, we didn't have lots of migrants. All these yellow areas have less than 5%, same as much of Eastern Europe. Because why would you go there? I'm being provocative. But years and years ago, I was on Radio Doncaster immediately after they announced the last pit closing. And we just done an atlas of where people have been born in Britain. And they said, Doncaster, why have we got so many Germans? I hadn't checked because the largest minority group in Doncaster were born in Germany. And the answer is cannon fodder, the Army of the Rhine, which I couldn't say just after they'd announced the last pit had closed. So I was trying to stumble my way around explaining that nobody goes to Doncaster, or did then. I won't go through this, save to say, here's a load of immigrants. This is the coast of Spain, it's Barcelona. All right, we don't call them immigrants, we call them, what's the word? Expats, thank you. Yes. Anyway. We're weird. Public spending as a proportion of GDP. There's an old graph of it. That's Ireland, just to include. We advised Ireland to bail out their banks completely, which was kind of not a good idea, which they did, and then they crashed. But we are here on this graph. We are low public spending. I've got a second, more detailed one, where you take Ireland out and Switzerland. Here's us. This is the red line. We're the lowest tax and spend country in Europe, apart from Ireland and Switzerland, which both have weird economies because of American companies based in Dublin and pharmaceutical companies. When people tell you that we're taxing highly, yes, we are. It's at a 70-year high. But not as highly as everywhere else in all these basket cases. Belgium, France, Finland, Norway, Denmark. You should go there. They're eating dogs in the street because, you know, if you tax people that highly, nothing works. You should see the tens of thousands of people who are homeless in Helsinki. It's unbelievable. The schools. Can you believe how bad the schools are on the European mainland when they do this? I'm being facetious, but honestly, I've spent 30 years of my working life having to talk about this stuff. And there comes a point when you just get sick of it. I won't go through, this is when I'm doing schools, who does a degree who's ever had a free school meal? The least likely is geography. So I'm a bit like casting stones and glass houses. And we have enormous amounts of data, enormous amounts. We know what happens to people who as children claim any benefit, what kind of school they go to. This is independent schools and people claiming free school meals, what kind of university they might go to if they go to university at all, and then what income they get. We have everything counted. We're very good. We're not a nation of shopkeepers. We're a nation of bean counters. Right? We do have very good data. Right at the end, I'm going to hand these out because I want to get rid of them. So you can take one or not, but please pass them on and pass them towards the back of the room. And they're an advert for the next book because this book, Shattered Nation, is depressing. The next book's called Seven Children, and it's different because it's trying to explain something, the same kind of thing, but in a different way. Supposing you were to try to identify seven typical children in the UK, who would they be and what would their lives be like? This is their household incomes. There were 14 million children in 2018. We divided them into several groups of 2 million. So there's 2 million by household income. Take the one in the middle, that's how much they've got. These are the most unequal children in Europe. They live parallel lives. They will not mix with each other very much. They'll go to different schools in different areas. Some of them, to be honest, actually slightly to the right of child number seven, their parents pay for them not to mix with other children. Remarkable. Doesn't happen elsewhere on the continent. Hardly at all. And did you know, on the mainland, apart from Malta and Ireland, Ireland's almost the mainland now, on the mainland, they don't wear school uniform, and children behave. Anyway, it's this magical place, this mainland Europe. Good news, things you can do. If I had more time, I would get you to guess which country in Europe has had the most progressive social policy for children in the last 3 or 4 years. And I've done this now a dozen times, and the guesses kind of go Norway, Denmark, Germany, and so on. The answer, because I've got no time, is Scotland. Scotland has enacted what may be the biggest redistribution of money towards the poorest children seen anywhere in Europe since 1989. You don't get told what goes to happen in Scotland. You'll know all about a camper van where there isn't a receipt for that camper van. It's a terrible camper van. It's a bigger issue than 15 billion of PPP kind of corruption. But you're not told that as the cost of living crisis began to get worse, Nicola Sturgeon convened the COBA crisis committee again weekly, as they did in COVID, to work out what to do because the cost of living crisis can kill more people than COVID. And she introduced a special Scottish child payment First of all, £10 a week for every child under six in a family receiving any kinds of benefit untapered, so you don't lose it if you get it. And then increased over a year ago to £25 every week for every child under 16. If you've got three children under 16 and you're in receipt of any benefit, which is two out of seven children in Scotland, you will be getting an extra £4,000 a year, which means that no child in Scotland need go cold or hungry at all. We are not told about this. We're not told that you can't evict people in Scotland now in the way that you could before. We're not told of all of these kind of things. Oh, the graph, by the way, these are all the wage crises that there have been, and the current one is the largest wage crisis. Wages are still not back to 2008 levels. Last time this happened was 1798 to 1822. That was one that Will Hutton took. Not that I'm bitter. I'll share with Will anytime. Inequality. Bulgaria, their figures are now out of date, could occasionally beat us. Bulgaria also has gone for the same number of heads of state who were prime ministers, but at least they had an election for each one. Right? We didn't. If you want kind of measures of failure. What happened over time, that V-shaped graph is our inequalities falling, then our inequalities rising. It's really nice and kind of simple. Things were getting better and better and better. Then they turn. Once they turn, it's very hard to stop the momentum of more and more greed. But it does eventually stop. It has to stop. It always stops. And the interesting thing is that when it does stop, when it does turn, when the inequalities begin to reduce, the good news, by the way, is they have. The last 2 years of pay deals have almost all been progressive. 2019, the communication workers, their union agreed a deal of 3% across the board. Everybody got 3% more. If you're high paid, normally my age, normally male, telephone engineer, your salary went up by 3% of what it was already, i.e. more than anybody else's salary. The communication workers union deal now, the latest one, is progressive. It doesn't go up for those paid at the top, or hardly at all, most of those at the bottom, because otherwise people are going to starve because of inflation. Every public sector deals like this. Right? And all the private sector ones I pick. And by the way, the Murdoch newspapers. Well, I shouldn't, I can tell you because I don't work for them. I'm just told by their journalist. I think it's above £60,000. You get no increase on your salary if you're writing that stuff in the newspapers. Because you can't carry on increasing inequality forever and not have people starving. Will mentioned this one. We have more and more data. Our children, on average, are getting shorter. We used to have to calculate really complicated things. It begins, by the way, and this matters, in 2010 for children aged five. So if you really love Gordon Brown and you really love Tony Blair, I'm afraid something occurred between 2005 and 2010 that began our children, on average, not getting taller. Right. In other words, lots of nice sure start centres, lots of double glazing in council houses, inequality increased, nutrition got worse. The million children taken out of poverty were taken out of poverty so slightly over a line that none of their families actually noticed and they didn't get taller. It dips for Germany. I think it was early today, somebody mentioned Angela Merkel. More radical, by the way, than Jeremy Corbyn as a politician over her policies. Anglia, when the girl cried, allowed 1.5 million in, mainly from Syria, included a lot of children. Children fleeing from a war zone tend to be short, slight dent on the German curve. Nothing compared to what we do to our children. The saddest is child mortality. We are of an age, on average, in this room, that you'll remember Jennifer's ear. You remember that? The whole controversy about one girl getting an operation on their ear or not? January this year, two-year-old boy starves to death next to his dad. It's eventually found. It made the headlines for 3 weeks. It's about 300 of them. We have a national child mortality database, so we actually know pretty rapidly how many extra children are dying, particularly between the ages of 1 to 4 in this country compared to before. So it is bad. I'm trying to be optimistic. This maybe is the most damning thing. The Innocente Center, who work for UNICEF, I think this might be report number 14. For decades, they've been reporting on child poverty in the rich world. And this is their latest report that came out in December last year. All those countries at the top are getting better rapidly. Very few countries are seeing a rise in child poverty, but one is above all others. It also happens to be one with a high rate of child poverty, unlike France, unlike Switzerland, unlike Norway. We've had tiny increases on the lowest levels of child poverty ever recorded, and it is the United Kingdom. You don't want to be recording more shattered than this, right? This wasn't a fun book to write. It wasn't a hard book to write in the end. The first draft was completed as Liz Truss resigned. I began writing the book when I thought people needed to know that people like her were going to be a bad idea, but we put her there anyway. It wasn't a hard book to write, it's a very sad book to write. But hope. We already have a turn that we last saw around about 1918 in terms of wages. We have increased benefits by inflation, although not by the inflation that people actually suffer who are poor because the price of food has gone up faster. But we didn't have to do that, and we did. A Conservative minister did in the very last weeks. Was it last summer? Feels like an age ago. The very last weeks. She did say you cannot tell those children that they've got to go into those assembly rooms and classrooms, where at any moment, without warning, the concrete might collapse on their heads. Her colleagues didn't want her to do that, right? These are good signs. They may not be very hopeful signs, right? But things are getting better. You might think, what on earth are we going to do with so many buildings, including the hall of an Oxford college, which students can't go into because we haven't looked after the concrete? We have more square meters of space set aside for education than any other country in Europe. We just don't share out the classrooms. We have more spare bedrooms than we've ever had before per person. We just don't share them out. We've got enough stuff. We're not going to get much more. We're not going to get richer on our main industries, which are gambling, banking, and higher education. But we actually have enough to go round. We're getting an election. Could be in the autumn, could be January. Something's going to change. Not, I would say, because of how you're going to vote. Although it is important to vote, and you hope it matters, but the two main parties' policies are remarkably similar. Rachel Reeves will spend $5 billion more. That's the error in the national accounts. Something's going to change because this cannot carry on. You cannot have local authorities going bankrupt. You cannot have a country operating in this way. You cannot have rising mortality amongst children. You can't have the heights of your children falling. You can't have a life expectancy lower than it was in 2014. You can't be at the bottom of so many European league tables and falling. And something's already begun to change. But they have to wait for the election. And then they can begin to do more of what they've already started doing. Going to have to tax more. Going to have to tax wealth more. They're going to have to make sure that people can eat at the bottom. It's going to be painful. The last time this happened, between 1918 and 1939, when half of the inequality that we used to have went, there was incredible social unrest, a general strike, stress. They built walls in the city of Oxford, where I grew up, to stop school children walking to school because they might reduce the house prices of the, you know. When inequalities fall, when we begin to come more similar to each other, it isn't a moment of great happiness. It's a moment of huge fear, particularly amongst those who've got wealth, because it's having to be shared. But what we could do, and this is where I'll end, so please ask me questions. What we could do is just for once, we could look at what other countries have done. How they've dealt with this, how they've come together when they've had to. Or we could look at our past and what we did when we went from a nation where the most common job for women was to be a servant to a nation where when a judge said, is this a book you would wish your wife and servants to read? He was laughed out of court. We could look at our past, we could look at other countries, and we could look at our imagination, and we don't have to go through two painful decades of adjustment to get out of the most terrible mistake this country has made in a century. Thank you very much.
We do have time for questions. Thank you, Robert. So, in your hands, the first one I saw is yours, sir. I'm coming to you.
Apologies, that was 15 minutes over my target. Faster than Will, though.
Thanks for your talk, Danny. Yeah, Donald. Just on the Doncaster and Brexit, I know you used to be at the University of Sheffield, you might have something against Doncaster. Just to correct the record a bit, a number of people voted to leave to take back control, which doesn't mean they didn't necessarily want more immigrants, they might have, but they wanted control over the levels of immigration, which obviously UK didn't have within the EU. And you can see that's even more of an issue today, because that control hasn't been, you know, given. And Keir Starmer, I mean, who would expect that, made a big speech about his own yesterday, Natalie Elphick's constituency. So just to correct the record, I was interested in your point about what we don't hear about Scotland, and I agree the rest of the UK has poor coverage of Scottish politics. But when you talk about statistics about, you know, relieving poverty that under the Sturgeon government and so on, no one ever talks about what the impacts of that are. Because, you know, so you're redistributing wealth now, that may be a good thing, but every policy will have some negative impact or externality. And I just see that as being a way in politics that we don't talk about. We only talk about the positive things, we don't talk about the negative things. And you talk about the cost of living crisis perhaps having more impact on mortality than the pandemic. I think that's really interesting. We didn't talk about that in the pandemic. We talked about only, you know, deaths within 28 days of having lost deaths from COVID. And only now we're talking about the impact, you know, 2 years later. Mm. So I think it's an interesting thing that we're not presenting the rounded data and the policy evidence, if you like, and that's, you know, what I really like you and John Murdoch, who you're talking about doing. So I just wonder why it is that we're not telling both sides of the story, and how, what's the one thing in the way that statistics are presented by either media or politicians that really gets you riled they should not do?
Okay, thank you. I get most riled at myself. Actually, because it's so easy, and you've seen it with me, you know, I obviously believe a set of things. And when statistics come along, which fit what I believe, I parrot them out to you. It's only when you come across things that you think are the opposite, where actually you think you've made a mistake. We were once drawing a map of where there were most stepchildren in the country, and we got the highest number in the Cotswolds and the lowest in Hull. We just assumed, oh, we must have just got it wrong. We calculated it, we were right. The Cotswolds is full of reconstituted families in chocolate box cottages where two of the children are not his and two are not hers, but there's four when they look. And in Hull, very few people get married. So you don't have any stepchildren. So it's only when, on Brexit, the highest correlation was with immigration in that the less you had, the more likely you were to vote to leave. The more immigrants that live around you. But also, you're doing well. Immigrants come to areas that are doing well. However, my view on that was changed by doing 100 public talks after the referendum in leave voting areas of the South. The majority of the vote to leave was in the South, which contains a minority of the electorate. I've still not got this one over. We published it in the British Medical Journal because you get a statistical review. It wasn't Stoke. It wasn't Middlesbrough, places like this. Because the vote was so skewed to being older, people are much older down here than in the north of England. So I did 100 talks with my friend Sally. And what I learned, not from numbers, but from talking, was that the people who at least came to our talks, we had a flag of the UK to try to get the right kind of people coming, because I didn't want to talk to Remainers, because I live in Oxford, 80% Remain. Most of the people who turned up were old, they had grandchildren, they voted Leave for their grandchildren, they wanted their grandchildren to be able to get a home, they wanted their grandchildren to be able to get a job that was in any way secure, and they wanted their grandchildren to be able to start a family to do what they had been able to do in the 60s and 70s. And the only vote that they'd been offered in their lifetime in most cases was this, because their general election vote is pointless because you know what's going to happen with first past the post where you live. And that changed my mind on, it was actually a hopeful vote for change, not for themselves. In fact, those who had a second home in France went on holiday, you know, if they knew they were going to be involved, it was for the grandchildren. The problem is that grandchildren's lives have not been made worse because we were in the European Union. The European Union contains the countries on earth with the best records in terms of education, in terms of health, in terms of children's rights. It's inequality. Inequality damages certainly the poor, but also the well-off as well, who are fearful. Lastly, on the cost of doing what Scotland does, it's calculated. It's pretty minimal and falling because the number of children being born each year is falling. So minimal means, I almost quipped, just between you and me, the legal tax evasion done by university professors and hospital consultants in Scotland kind of almost covers it. It's not, because it's only £20 a week per child. It's a tiny amount of money. I began working in this area in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And we used to go to Glasgow, Shettleston. That's one of the poorest parts of the UK, of Europe. Glasgow was one of the poorest parts of Europe. And I wouldn't believe it. I should, if I had one more graph, I should put it up. Of all the regions of England, including the southeast where we are now, which doesn't include London, that's a separate region. All the regions of England, including the southeast, now have a higher child poverty rate than Scotland. Right. Scotland does better than the richest parts of England in terms of children not being poor. What's the cost? You could work it out in pounds, but I would say what you've got down here is a divided, disunified society where people don't actually know how others' lives are lived within the same region, admittedly a weird donut-shaped region, where you could go just 16 minutes and 30 seconds drive south and see people living in squalor, which you won't see if you don't, and you need never do, and you could be live a separate parallel life. Whereas in Scotland, what they're beginning to do is to see each other as people. And that changes how you treat people and whether you think any saving of money is worth doing if a child's going to go hungry or a child's going to be cold in winter. And if you see each other as people, then you decide that every child needs to be warm and every child needs to have food. The latest statistic from the Resolution Foundation, it's almost a year out of date now, 56% of children in England who've got two siblings or more, most of them have only got two, 56% of them are going seriously hungry several times a month. Not peckish, malnourished. A majority of our children with a brother and sister in England are now malnourished several times a month. This happened in the 1930s. But there's almost certainly nobody here who was not a child at that time. None of us can remember this. You'll remember when we didn't have food banks. Some of you remember when they came in. Right? As the inequality rose, we had to bring in food banks. Now we have more than we have McDonald's. they're escalating and escalating. And then, because of inflation, everything is costing 25% more for almost everybody, but more for the poor. It's just out of control. But if you're in the 10%, taking 40% of everything, my group, most of your group, okay, that's one skiing holiday down. We can go abroad at summer or Easter, but not both. Or maybe you can't redo the kitchen this year. That's what a 25% drop in living standards means for us. For other people, it's hunger. And this changes the politics of it, as long as you know it's happening. And in Scotland, they know it's happening. We only report down here the arguments in Scotland. Gordon Brown, last summer, criticised the Scottish Child Payment. He said it was inefficient. It should be done through DWP. It's costing money. Scottish Labour told him to shut up. Scottish Labour, the Labour Party in Scotland, and the SNP are absolutely united on this policy. Right? The cost of not doing that is the mess we have down here of a Labour Party which has abandoned a commitment to child benefit for the third child. What is the primary reason why 56% of children are going hungry several times a month for a brother and sister? It's the removal of child benefit for the third or subsequent child. There's a huge amount you can do, but you need to know what's going on in the UK.
Question there, let's get the mic to you.
Thank you very much. I've worked with children all my professional life. I know the graph that you put up at the end. It is such a shame. When I was young, we were all waiting for the court report. It came out in 1976, you remember? Yeah. And it said the rearing of the young is the fundamental issue in a human society. Mm. And what had happened to Britain by the mid-1970s was that the wealthy children had exchanged stability for prosperity, and the rest were as disadvantaged as ever. That's 50 years ago.
Yeah.
We had report after report. We had the National Children's Bureau, which followed the children through, as you know, from the Newcastle study. We had Professor Goldstein, who refused to take an honour because they said they never applied any of the reports that he published. Why is it that people are so deaf? Because children are the main natural resource of a country. If you neglect your children, you ruin your future.
Thank you. I think it was Baroness Warnock, maybe in 76, who did. They're deaf, I think, because they're convinced that this isn't true. They're convinced that people have got mobile phones and televisions, and they're told stories of fecklessness and bad behaviour and troubled families and the minority, and most people are well behaved. Those stories were largely untrue, even when they were first told of an underclass in the 1980s. But because we believed, or some of us, or enough of us believed the untrue stories about fecklessness and bad families, as opposed to us, thrifty, well-behaved people who have most holidays. A third of children never have a summer holiday, by the way. Because we believed that, or enough of us believed that, we carried on along this route. Which is why it's taken to the point where you're getting majorities of children being shorter in height. It's very hard to paint a majority as being some feral minority. And that's why it's got to that. It's tragic. You could have asked, could we have done it earlier? But you could also ask, what happens if it gets worse? You know, you can turn and look at the United States, where the number of women, mothers who are evicted can be 1 in 13 in parts of Baltimore, and families are thrown onto the streets. You can look at the crime rates there. So it can get worse. That's important. And the other side of the question about why us, is why were our political progressive parties not capable? It isn't just that we've had the most successful political party in the world with the Conservative Party. There's something about the UK, as opposed to other European countries, and all countries have their political disagreements within themselves. But something about us that meant our Liberal Party and then the Social Democrats forming and helping Labour lose the 83 election and the battles on, really ineffectual opposition to those who were driving this. And I think it is partly our past. It's our colonial past. It's our schooling system, which educates people so separately they do not know the lives of others. You know, it wasn't Tony Blair's fault that he went to Fetters, the Eton of Scotland, a military school. But it certainly meant that he wouldn't have understood other people's lives very well before he turned up at St. John's College, Oxford. And St. John's College, Oxford, nice as it is not somewhere you go to understand society, right? Which is why the two MPs in my life, in my hometown, Andrew Smith and Annalise Dodds, who are both nice enough people, St. John's College, Oxford students, Oxford East MP, you can't run a country where your ruling elite have grown up so separated from the rest that their gut instinct is pity or charity. That's so different. If you look back at somebody like an Ivan Bevan and why he did it, or even Harold Wilson and what Harold Wilson experienced as a child growing up in the 1930s. And why have our politicians been so disengaged from the rest? Because we have an education system which creates apartheid. Why do we have an education system, including a university hierarchy, where we scatter our middle-class children across the country, unlike in a normal European country, where at least if you go to university, you stay where you grew up, so you might stay with your friends. Why do we have that? Because it's highly, highly efficient to teach people how to bully people. And you have to know how to bully if you're going to rule the world. And so we have a legacy of this, and it's turned in on ourselves. The bullying we used to do in other places that we would call civilizing them has been turned on ourselves and turned on our children and turned on our poor. And it's difficult. It's really hard to get out of that. And it's, if you want an extreme example, the Scots looked to the Nordic nations as a model. If you look at somewhere like Finland, which is my favorite country that I've written a book about with a Finn, Annika Koljonen, age 22 when we wrote it, better English than me, writes four languages, speaks six. The Finns had a civil war in 1918. Huge numbers had to leave, and it was an incredibly divided country. We don't want a civil war, but we have these divisions amongst ourselves, which we tend not to see. And you can see them in the statistics. So that seven children thing going around is all about who can actually do mundane things like fix the washing machine when it breaks. You know, just the simple side of it. Four of the seven, by the way, are poor now. A majority, in how I define it, not the ONS way. I'll give you away the, maybe I shouldn't. The rich kid, number seven, she's called Gemma. They all have names. Her mum and dad run a corner shop. Only a million children in the UK are better off than Gemma. After taxes and after paying their mortgage, her mum and dad are £25,000 a year above that. 50 grand disposable income a year for the family. That's our posh kid. And she goes to a state school. Right. The problem is that people who are as well off as me don't realise how well off they are. And that's how you can get a situation crumbling to this extent. that whole councils are going bankrupt. They can't do their statutory duties, the basic things they have for social protection, which includes, you know, if you want to be selfish about it, adult social care, which means somebody just turning up for only 15 minutes to put the kettle on, make you a tea, and leave again. And you might say, well, that's pointless, but it's not pointless if you're at the bottom of the stairs because you've fallen. Over half of those people went in the 5 years after 2 terms of austerity. Austerity deaths far, far exceed the deaths caused by COVID. That's from 2010 to 2019. And they're mainly of the elderly and mostly, increasingly, of the well-off elderly, because you don't get to be in your late 80s or 90s if you're not better off earlier in life. Right? The tragedy, and we just published a paper, Lucinda Hyam and me, on the Golden Cohort. The Golden Cohort, you're born between 1925 and 1934, the best health ever, the best improvement ever in health. We thought there was something magical about them. Fastest mortality ever since 2010. Meals on Wheels going, adult social services going. Absolute calamity. And how did the Golden Cohort vote in most of their adult lifetime? They voted Conservative. And they suffered at the end of it. I'm not into arguing for doing the right thing for self-interest, but honestly, you know, unless you're so rich you can afford your own social care in the case of the worst disaster happening for you, or really expensive private healthcare when things go badly, badly wrong, it really is in your interest to ask for this to change, because at least most of the young are young. I mean, they're going hungry. They're going to be shorter and skinnier. But they're not going to be suffering as much as the old are going to suffer in the next few years, in their last year of life. Right? I promise to cheer you up, but, well, if only people would realise this, why on earth would they vote for please lower my taxes? Please lower my taxes so that the person inserting the catheter doesn't know what they're doing. I mean, think about the last year of your life. Or those you love. What on earth are we doing? What on earth were we doing having 4 times fewer incubators than Germany, not having MRI machines? What are we doing running down a national health service so that 1 in 10 people every year, not 1 in 10 people who are ill, 1 in 10 of everybody is going private? And yes, you can pay for your cataracts and your knees and your hips, but you can't pay for the more serious stuff that's going to happen, right? So I know. Sorry, I'll be shorter in the other ones, but I just, exasperation over, when it was said there's no such thing as society, only people and their families, it assumed that you could create your own little welfare state to look after yourself, which you could for a while there was a bigger welfare state out there for when your mini one wouldn't work. But once the bigger one's gone, your little welfare state, a kind of Jane Austen novel welfare state where you go and ask, nice Auntie Enid, please can I have some money? Your little welfare state isn't going to work anymore. And we've taken ourselves to that limit, and we have to start to get out of it. We're either going to do it painfully and slowly over 2 decades, or we could do it a bit quicker. I don't care which political party does it. I just don't want to have to listen to any more. We just need to increase productivity and growth. Right, and the sunlit uplands are there. And if you follow my economic plan, then within 5 years, we'll be the best country in the G7. George Osborne's promise of 2015 for the year 2030. Johnson's promise on his vaccination speech, just follow the plan. Keir Starmer's promise last summer. Same thing, same growth, same slightly watered down stat about how we'd be great again as a country. Forget being great as a country. Try to be an average European country, not in the bottom fifth on all these measures, right? Just suck it up. We're not going to be Singapore on Thames. We don't have a safe banking system. We do bring in an enormous number of overseas students who bring in a lot of money for the exchequer, but they could just decide not to come 1 year. We are the world leader in the gambling industry. More money for gambling flows to this country than for the whole of the United States. It's not anything to be proud of, and it's not safe. We no longer make our own steel. No other country in the G7 no longer makes its own steel. There are worries about the supply of food and when we'll get it. It's serious. But it would help to address it faster. And I really don't care which of the politicians that we're being offered does it. I just want them to get out of the fantasy of thinking that they can keep on promising us the same thing because it's just becoming too obvious. I don't want to have to write another book saying it's got worse.
Spend a quick 5 minutes for a question and an answer.
Okay.
So you did a piece of very interesting research when you were at Sheffield about the different wars and educational output. And so I was at one of those very well comprehensive schools in South Sheffield, you know, Larches and Paperwork, very, very well. When I was at school, only 10 of us out of the recruited 30 for each university. I was one of them. But in your cohort study, you're saying very many more children from those schools are going to university. So my question is, why is this not impacting on inequality and also the effects of North South Divide in terms of opportunity and the impact on policy? Because if you grow up in North, you grow up in areas where you see the divided industry, you know, very different type of, it's so different from here.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll do it. The report is called The Tale of Two Cities. For the purposes of transparency, it was funded £9,000 by David Blunkett. I thought that'd be fine, middle of the road. The Liberals threatened to cut off all planning permissions to the University of Sheffield when we took the money. We produced maps of Sheffield showing that if you grew up in one half of the Hallam, the posh constituency, you were odds on to go to an old university just by being born there. And in the other half, you're odds on to go to a post-92 university. And in other constituencies, you're odds on to be unemployed and so on. Your future was determined by your postcode, not by how hard you worked. And again, data. We had data tracking children from the whole country on these things. Tony Blair increased the going to university and brought in student loans to allow it to increase so fast, first 1,000, then 3,000, then £9,000, now 9,250 a year tuition fees. Over 50% of our young people go to university by 18, 65% by the age of 30, the highest number in all of Europe go to university, with a promise that they're going to be better off than average. 65% go to university with a promise that they're going to be better off than average. It's only numerically possible if the other 35% are in some kind of form of indented labour being paid nothing. It doesn't work. And I'm not against, I think we are going to slowly move to an effect school leaving age being 21, but we should have far more varied things going on in our universities, and they should be primarily local, especially mine. Anyway, that will 200 years for that target. We've sold our youngsters a promise that they'll get. So my school can be verified. It was 10 of us within a year or 2 years out of 330 who went to university. I was always going to go. I was a doctor's son. So the number who went who weren't predicted was tiny. We were sorted. From the age of 18, I walked into Newcastle University. That's it, 1986. I'm going to be fine. Because we're only part of 10% nationally. A degree was just it. You could fail, but it's very, very hard to. The tragedy is watching this 65% now, people under 30, blaming themselves for the situation they've got into because they've got a degree and they haven't got a high-paid job. All the ones who've dropped out and repeated and have to pay much more than 9,250 times three because they've done 4 or 5 years, or they haven't completed their degree but they still earn the money and then there's the money for their accommodation. We sold them a kind of American dream. And it was idiotic. And it was Lord Adonis, it was David Willetts, it was Peter Mandelson, who organised the agreement between the two education secretaries, and it was Blair not understanding the country and Brown not getting it, and just what a mess, and Joe Johnson not understanding either. But, yeah, and we were going to powerhouse our way to Singapore 2.0. You know, we made a mistake, and we're not going to get out of that mistake. You're not going to suddenly change it. One big danger is that the minute there is an election, the day after the election, whoever's in power will take the cap off fees so that any university can charge any amount to any student. So we're like the US, £60,000 a year to go to certain universities. Why might they do this? It's rumoured, it's already in the Times Higher as being likely. They can't say a word, either party, before the election, because who's going to vote for that? Because we've got a whole series of universities on the verge of bankruptcy, which you can't say, because the minute you mention the name of a university and financial difficulties, people stop applying, and then that's it. We have a contingency fund from the Higher Education Fund of 65 million in total to cope with universities going bankrupt and merging them. It's not enough. Why? But everything's teetering. The universities, the health services, the councils, everything's teetering. Inflation might come down to 3%. That still means that everything will cost in a few months' time 30% more than it did 2 years ago, and we haven't got any more money to pay for it. It's an emergency. That's what this election is being held in, is a state of national emergency without anybody admitting it is an emergency, because Labour don't want to have to say what they're going to have to do, and the Conservatives don't want to have to admit what they've done. So you're being told, you know, nothing much will change, but we'll be a bit tougher on those migrants and do something about the biggest fear of all, a small boat.